Was Jerry coming back in?
Yes.
Okay. All right, well, welcome to Bible class this morning. It's good to see you all out here this morning. As we get ourselves underway, we always remind ourselves of the fact that as we gather together, we do so as members of the body of Christ and not just as any old group gathering together for some other reason. And as Paul reminds us that whether one member of the body suffer, all the members suffer with it. Whether one member be honored, all the members rejoice with it. And so in this time of announcements, you have an opportunity to let us know if there's anything that you'd like to make the assembly aware of before we get ourselves underway. Everybody doing okay? That's probably good because I got something we're going to take a look at here this morning. But if there's anything, glad to see Cecil with us today.
Glad to be here.
Glad to be seen.
Yeah. And Andrew and Caroline are visiting with us. Are you cold? Sitting next to that wall, you're going to get it. Yeah. Yeah, and I honestly, that thing is set on 71, and but I was sweating profusely yesterday, and I thought I'm not going to do it today. I'm going to be cool. So, all right. So we may have some people coming in a little late, but let's get ourselves underway this morning. Anybody got anything else they'd like to share with the assembly? If not, that's all right. Okay. Well, this morning, as you've seen, and we talked about a little bit on Wednesday night, we've actually had not one but two American heroes who have passed away. Kenny Stumpf is a Medal of Honor recipient that I was very, very familiar with, and it wasn't just a one-time meeting type thing, but I explained on Wednesday how Kenny was so gracious to me to have me up to Fort Sheridan and take me through there, and we spent an entire day together. And then whenever I would see Kenny on any of the times that I was with the Medal of Honor recipients, I got an opportunity to rekindle our friendship. And I actually had I don't know if you'd call it an artifact, but I had a very odd thing that was Medal of Honor related. My dad had found this too, but this was back in the days when you had actual LPs, and my dad had found a two album set on a Medal of Honor recipient that you probably have heard of. His name was Pappy Boyington. He was a very famous Marine pilot from World War II. And it was just somebody, they must have just stuck a microphone in front of him, and he just told his whole life story. And I had recorded it off, and I gave it to Ken, and Ken was thrilled with it. He said, "I've never seen anything like that." And he said, "I met Pappy, and he had a real neat, there's a picture of that he had," and he said, "I'm so glad to have that." And so we were able to trade things around. So Ken, like I say, was not a recipient that I met but didn't know well. And he died, I believe he was 77. He died about 2 weeks ago, and he died from pancreatic cancer. I learned just day before yesterday that another Medal of Honor recipient had died by the name of Johnny Lee Canley. Now, we'll talk about him at another time, but he's a very recent recipient, but he was a recipient from Vietnam. And I think his award was a Distinguished Service Cross that was bumped up to the Medal of Honor. He was presented as Medal of Honor by President Trump, but he died. And so the number of living Medal of Honor recipients that we have in this country now stands at 64. And this morning I want to honor Ken how much I was just thrilled to be able to call him my friend. In fact, I showed this on Wednesday. I'll show it to you here. I have a picture of me and him. together. There we are. That's me when I didn't have gray hair. And you can see I'm not tall, and Ken was shorter than me. And his sense of humor was incredible. And I know instead of reading his Medal of Honor citation, we have these little videos that we will play. This particular video you're going to see is from a series that was done back in the 80s that I have, and I don't know I don't know if anybody else has this or not. So you're going to get to hear him tell his story. And this was what I first saw of Ken that attracted me to him, and especially about his great sense of humor. So this doesn't run very long, but I think these guys deserve the recognition, and just amazing what Ken performed that day. And I'll let this tell the story. So here is the little video on that.
25 years after Ed Michaels stood before the president, selfless heroism would bring another gallant soldier to the White House.
Turn it up just a little more. Okay.
Despite the elaborate pretense of technology, the war in Vietnam belonged to the grunts, the ground troops who lived, fought, and died in regions as malignant as any on Earth. For Ken Stump, a 23-year-old printer from Menasha, Wisconsin, Vietnam was one long struggle punctuated with helicopter assaults, monsoon rains, jungle rot, long episodes of tropical boredom probing hedgerows and villages on the fringe of swamps, and the random violence of booby traps, snipers, and ambushes staged by a phantom army which disappeared like shadows into the jungle deltas. The enemy controlled the countryside, all of it, staging hit-and-run raids from ingeniously hidden tactical bases. Linked by a labyrinth of tunnels and trenches, these bunker complexes were invariably well-fortified, heavily defended, and often invulnerable to anything short of a direct strike by B-52s. Trailing a wounded enemy soldier, Stump and his squad would suddenly find themselves fighting for their lives, trapped in the middle of such a fortification. And before that day was over, Ken Stump would know as well as anyone can how much trial the human heart can bear.
I lost points almost all the time in Vietnam. I felt the responsibility, especially for the new soldiers, and I felt just because I'm the squad leader don't mean that I can't be out there. I don't like to do it because I paid attention a lot. I mean, a lot of people will daydream and go back, and I didn't have a wife and whatever to think about while I'm walking down the trail. It was always my mind was on what's out there in front of us. But most of all, I wanted to set the example. So I was walking point at the time and couldn't find this North Vietnamese. So I told the guy, I said, we're going to stop right here. I was walking down the trail. I said, I'm going to go back, and I'm going to go talk to Sergeant Donovan. So he was ready to just call back in and tell him, hey, we didn't find this guy. So I must have got 15 steps going back down the line, and the guy in the front took the squad, and he walked around the corner, and that's where all the North Vietnamese were in bunkers. So I heard all the firing ran away, so I turned around and I went up there to see what was going on. And one of the guys came running out to a back door to me and he says, hey, there's three guys that are wounded next to this bunker complex because they spotted each other right at the same time. And just everything opened up. So the four of us got into this trench right across from the bunkers, but I didn't know exactly where these guys were. All I knew that they were out in front because there was, at the time, I didn't know there was these trenches. And but I knew it was right kind of close to head on. So I tried to get into them, and I always these North Vietnamese. What they did is they sealed when they got us inside there. They sealed off the rest of the perimeter. nowhere to go. But I still knew that, you know, there was three of my guys were still laying inside there, and when this guy came running back and told me, he says, God, they're really messed up. And they're laying there on the trail. And two of the guys were my brand new guys. They were the two guys that just got into my squad. So we sat and it was just a matter of, hey, you look that way, you look that way, you look that way, and I'll look this way or whatever. And I tried to get in close to him about two or three times, and I couldn't get two steps out of that trench. And the firepower, the grenade falling everywhere, and I just got pushed back into that trench all the time, but I always had it on my mind, and I was so scared. I had it on my mind that I've got to get these guys out. That's my people. And so after about an hour and a half, I just made up my mind. I said, this is it. I'm going to bed. You're going to have to stop me. And so I went in there towards the bunkers, and I got into the three guys, and I looked at them. Oh, they were shot up really bad, but they were still alive. And so I started dragging them on my back. Now, I was only about 15, 20 meters away from where the bunker complex was, back to this trench. So I got one of them back, and then I went out at the next one. And one new guy, he was 6'8" tall. I mean, the biggest guy in the world, and I'm 5'5", weighing 130 pounds, and I'm grabbing this guy, just hauling butt with him. So got him back into the trench area, and then again, these three people now, they're immobile. Now the rest of the people in my squad, the other three guys, now they're wounded. And so I'm the only person that is not wounded. So I really have, you know, besides having the responsibility of being a squad leader, and these are my people, these are Americans, I had to, I was the one that I had to do it. I had the mobility to do it, to do something. And I used to carry a sandbag full of grenades on my back. Everywhere I went, I carried that sandbag of grenades, and I carried about 40 magazines of M16 rounds. And in that 3 hours, I used about everything. All my grenades were gone, just about everything was gone. We didn't really have much ammunition left. Now the rest of my company, they started coming in, and what happened was they couldn't get into us because they sealed that perimeter off. And finally, about maybe 3 hours or so later, my company finally, some people broke through to us. We sat there and we fired for 3, 4, 5 more hours. And then we pulled back. He said, oh, I'm bombing the hell out of them. I mean, when the Air Force came in and they dropped these bombs, it was the scariest thing in the world. But the bombs would, you know, when they fall out of that plane, they would fall on top of it. And then things hit right on the money. I couldn't believe it. I just, what accuracy. And as soon as they had their bombing was finished up, they dropped the rope, off we ran back in close, got in close with them again, thinking that, hey, now we got you. We got that in there, and they came out of them bunkers just firing like crazy, and I couldn't even believe it, all the bombs going off, and just right in that area. So we did this 3 times. We'll pull back again, and bam, we bombed them again, and bombed them again. And each time, we'd run up there with the rest of our unit, and think that, hey, now we're going to overrun you. So each time we did, and we could not penetrate their defenses. So then, finally, it got to about, now this action started about 10 o'clock in the morning, now about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. And I told my company commander, Captain Bill, standing next to me, I said, sir, I says, we're going to have to make a charge. And I says, because it's getting dark, and I says, if it gets dark, they're gone. And I says, we're going to do something, we got to do it infantry style. So, he says, he went along with it. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I didn't know how to sleep properly, been in the army for a year and a half, and this guy. So anyway, down there. And I told him, I said, sir, I know where some bunkers are. I said, give me some of your grenades. And he gave me a bunch of grenades, and off I went. And destroyed a couple of bunkers and machine gun positions. And we finally kind of traded their defenses. After that, you know, everything, it was all over with. And then later on, people started talking about the Medal of Honor and, you know, things like that. And really, to show you how, what I did know, when I went and trained, when I first got the 25th Division, they were talking about this CMH. And the instructor said, if you want the CMH, you know, what his term to use, you know, was casket with a metal handle. he was talking about the communist hand grenade. So you jump on one of these things, he says, you'll get the CMH, cast it with a metal handle. You know, when I heard people talking about it, somebody told me, you know, that you've been recommended for the CMH. And to show you how naive I was, I've heard of congressional metal line, but I never heard of it. I said, well, what would I do? The casket with a metal handle for. You know, so then after a while people started talking about congressional medal of honor and this and that, whatever. So that's how then I left Vietnam and went back home to my old job and never thought anything more about it. And I just did what I felt was right and went on with my life. And it wasn't about June of 68 is when I got a call from Fort Sheridan saying they're going to send a plane up to pick you up and fly you back to Fort Sheridan and take your picture because you're going to Washington to get the Medal of Honor. I don't know.
Oh. He told me when we were up at Fort Sheridan together that it's customary. This is a myth. You'll hear people often say that it is law almost in the military to salute a Medal of Honor recipient, no matter what his rank is. There's no law about it, but it is customary that even a four-star general will initiate the salute to a buck private if he's got the Medal of Honor. And Kenny was talking about walking down the sidewalk there at Fort Sheridan, and he had his Class A's on, which isn't his medals, but it has all of his ribbons. And as he's walking by, a captain walked by him and stopped him. And he pointed to his chest history, and he pointed to the Medal of Honor ribbon, and he goes, Sergeant, he said, what is that little blue ribbon? Yeah. And Ken said, you know what I told him? I said, sir, I said, I happened to find that in a box of Cracker Jack and thought it looked pretty, and I thought I'd pin it on my uniform. And he said, I just walked on. He said, I could not believe that a captain in the United States Army would not know the Medal of Honor ribbon when he saw it. So, yeah, he said, I got that in a box of Cracker Jacks. All right. Well, anyway, great man, great American, and so I enjoyed sharing that with you. All right, before we get underway this morning, let's read the Word of God together. Now, please, would you open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. And verse 1, y'all should be able to find Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass and herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, and the herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also, and God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day. We'll stop right there. Before we get ourselves underway this morning, I'd like to ask Andrew, would you lead us in prayer, please? All right. Well, this morning we are going to continue our first lesson, which was on Wednesday night, kind of introducing the issue that we're going to be dealing with over the next several Bible classes. Instead of going right into 1 Corinthians, we're going to take a little bit of time. I don't know how much, but we're going to take some time to deal with what I call God's timeline through the Bible. And really, it's going to be trying to get an overall understanding of God's Word without having to go into a 5 or 6 year long history of Israel type thing. And I'm still having to adjust some things so that we can do this in a fairly quick way. But we're going to use as a basis for this the timeline chart that you see me use all the time. And as I said on Wednesday, this is what I call the full-blown timeline chart. When you throw that thing up in front of somebody brand new, it's almost like, as I said on Wednesday, it's almost like the Griswold house at Christmas time going on. It's like, there's just everything, and it's overloaded. It's information. I don't know what all these numbers are, and what are these things all about, and that doesn't look like Mount Sinai. That looks like Devil's Tower, and it is, but I don't have Mount Sinai, and there's all kinds of things on here, and so what we want to do, I want you to see how this chart builds from the very beginning. And so what I'm going to try to do is to build this chart, and you'll see all 66 books of the Bible underneath here, and they are arranged so that when you open your Bible, if you open it to, say, the book of Ruth, you can go straight up, and where that number one is up there, you know exactly where you are on God's timeline. And that one represents the first course of punishment for the nation of Israel. But we'll explain all of that as we go. And that's one of the things I am going to spend some time on, is so that you realize those five courses of punishment are all identifiable. You can find a verse in the Bible and put your finger on that verse and say, that's it. And so we're going to give you that information so that at the end of it, you could take this and be able to help somebody understand God's Word, and you can peel it back, and you can edit it to the point that you think it needs to be dealt with. And so hopefully this will give some who haven't been here for a long time the ability to catch up with some of the terms that we throw around a little bit, like these the five mandates of the Davidic covenant, those green circles up there, and those kinds of things will have some meaning. And it's not just that they have meaning, but they give you the means to to be able to act as markers in your Bible to know where you are, and everything you're reading then is within a particular context. And that's very important. And so what we're going to do is we're going to wipe this thing clean and really begin at the beginning. And that's exactly what we did on Wednesday. And so, let's see, it was like kind of like taking, and we'll come back to this one, starting right there. And then eventually we're going to have a line. And that's a whole lot simpler than that first chart I just showed you. I want to back that line off just a minute. So we begin here in Genesis chapter 1 at the very beginning. And what we did on Wednesday night, I'm not going to go back over all of it, but I think we've all, in fact, even the new people, have seen this particular chart. But it was a very important thing to realize. If I'm going to sit down, I'm going to talk to somebody about God's Word, or I've got a believer who is really displaying some honesty of heart and wants to deal honestly with the text, and I want to be able to lay things out for them. Where would you start? I always talk about, and this is just me, you do it however you want, but to me, any Christian is going to have an understanding of God and an understanding of Satan. And that's a great place to start. And that's where we started, and what we did on Wednesday night was to just go back over this chart, which you've seen before. As God creates the earth, before He ever creates, we just read 4 days. And I stopped for a reason at day four, because day four is when He creates the sun, the moon, and the stars. But on that first day, the earth was encased in water. On that first day, He most likely also created the angelic realm. And we'll get to that today of why that's true. On day two is the only day of the 6 days of creation that God does not say it was good. He says it's good on day 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, but not on day 2. If my understanding is correct, that's when the adversary, when Lucifer sinned and fell and took the usurpation over the heavenly realm and over the earth. And so this is the chart that we had gone over. And this morning I want to take you to starting to move into something here and answer a question that I think is rather interesting. And really what I want to do this morning is underscore the reason why God created it all. Why did He create this world? What was He didn't just do this for no reason. And so what I want to do is, I want to, without going back over everything that we did here on Wednesday, and there's a lot of great information here, but let's go ahead and start looking at an outline to the book of Genesis. So if I was going to do this, we would come to understand and appreciate that the book of Genesis, and we're going to have more on this a little bit later, but there are five major beginnings in the book of Genesis. By the way, this is reflected in Keith's new book back there as well. The word Genesis means beginning. And there are five major beginnings in the book of Genesis. In chapter 1, which verses 1 through 25, you have the beginning of the world laid out. And I'm just going to put these up here. They're very brief, and then we'll start looking at the first one. In chapter 1, beginning in verse 26, on day 6, you have the beginning of man. And of all of God's creation, man is the ultimate. He's a special aspect of God's creation, unlike anything else. Your great-great-great-great-grandfather was not an ape. I know people who that would very well fit and apply to. But when you see Bonzo, you know, some of you don't even remember Bonzo. Some of you do. But when you see a chimpanzee, you don't look at him and say, Grandpa. This is the beginning of man, and it runs down through chapter 2. Then we have the beginning of man's sinfulness and Satan's rulership of the world, beginning in chapter 3. The beginning of man's sinfulness and Satan's rulership of the world. Satan immediately knows what man is on this earth for. And he immediately attacks that rulership that man was originally given to take possession of it himself, because it completes his possession plan to be like the Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And then fourthly, you have Genesis chapter 4 all the way to the end of chapter 11. Genesis 4 all the way to the end of chapter 11 is the beginning of man's devolution. Man does not evolve up, he devolves down. The beginning of man's devolution. That's a word, by the way. Man is devolving, he's not evolving. And there's a great deal of time in those first 11 chapters. I know you can squeeze them in your fingers real tight and it doesn't make up much of the Bible, but there's a lot that went on there today. In fact, everything that you're seeing on this chart is still affecting us to this day. And then fifthly is the beginning of Israel. And that basically is chapter 12, verse 1 to the end of the 50th chapter. And there's 50 chapters to the book of Genesis. And from Genesis 12, where God calls Abram out of Ur of the Chaldees, you have the beginning of Israel. And the rest of the Bible, until you get to Paul, is all about God's program with Israel. So you see that by this, even with five major beginnings in the book of Genesis, Israel is really one-fifth of that. See how that connects with what we were talking about when Zacharias talked about when John the Baptist was born? We went and looked at that and said that he talks about this was made known by the prophets since the beginning of the world, which predates Israel. And by the way, for those of you who've been through this, beginning today, we're going to cover some things you may not have ever heard before. So I'm going to throw things in that for those of you who've been over this so that you get some new stuff too. So right now, we're going to concentrate upon that first beginning for a little bit, the beginning of the world. Let's look once again at verse 1, and let's get this back into our minds good and clear. Just a few verses. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Not the heavens, plural, but the heaven, singular. The heaven and the earth. And that's very important. And that's what I've tried to stress, and I can't stress this enough. And if I was dealing with a brand new person to all of this, that's what I would stress to them. God could have said, in the beginning, God created everything. In the beginning, God created it all. In the beginning, God created a whole bunch of things. He says specifically, he brings two things in front of you, the heaven and the earth. Those two realms from the very first verse of the Bible is what the rest of the Bible is going to be comprised of. Something going on with those two realms. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God, now you're confronted with God being more than one person, the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, some fascinating details that we can't get into here this morning, but you've heard it, that God could have thought it into existence. He didn't. He said it. He literally spoke. And the person doing this speaking is who? Jesus Christ. God the Son is the one that's doing the actual physical creation. And he just speaks. And that's important because of how he's going to emphasize his word is what's going to be important. And he said, let there be light, and there was light. And by the way, this light was not sunlight. This isn't the sun. The sun, moon, the stars aren't created until day 4. We're on day 1. No sun, no moon, no stars, but light. You say, well, how can that be? Well, look up. We're in here with light. That's not the sun. That's a light bulb. And there was a particular individual who was kind of the bearer of that light, and his name was Lucifer, who became Satan. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And then let's look at day two, because I want you to get this back in your mind. And God said, let there be a firmament. And by the way, notice it up there God said, let there be light. God saw the light that it was, verse 4, it was good. So he's talking about something good on that day. You're not going to see anything good on this day. But God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. So God puts this firmament in there, and he goes like this. Zoop! And there's going to be water up here, and there's going to be water down here. And it's amazing that NASA goes running around like a chicken with its head off whenever they discover there's a little bit of water out in outer space. Just read your Bible, NASA. You'll be way ahead of the game. God divided the water, divided the waters from the waters. In verse 7, God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. It was so. And God called the firmament heaven. The evening and the morning were the second day. And I want to just pick up the next verse. And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. Now get it in your head what's going on. God created two realms. He created the heaven and the earth, and he did this, and this is, might sound as a shock to you, but it won't be, in six, my understanding is, six literal days. Now, you may take a different position on that, whatever you want, but my understanding is he did this on six literal days. I like one little old lady who was listening to a scholar tell that this was not really a day, that it wasn't a day like we know a day, and all of this kind of business, and he retranslated it and everything. And after it was all over, she walked up to him and she said, could you just please tell me one thing? When in the Bible can I start trusting God to tell me what he actually said? I have no reason to believe this isn't a day. God calls it a day. But he creates in 6 days with no gap. My understanding is, I used to teach the gap. There's a huge gap of time between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. And we're not going to go into all of that. We've covered a lot of that, but it's been a long time ago. But there's to me, the Bible itself has no need for that gap of time. And I just love taking away the thing that scientists want me to give them as a Christian, and then they'll kick everything else to the curb. Just give them time. Give them millions of years and billions of years. Well, I won't do that. Yeah.
Along those lines, my understanding is that verse 1 is God saying, here's what I did, and then verses 2:1 is, here's how I did it back.
Yeah, you're immediately introduced to a method in which God teaches his word in Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. And it's what Keith coined the phrase, and I think it was a good phrase, he called it looping parallelism. He tells you what he does, and then he'll loop back and he'll tell you more about it. You're going to get it there. You're going to get it again in chapter 2, because you're going to get in chapter 1, he creates man. In chapter 2, he loops back, and he's going to go over the details of what he did when he created man. And that looping back is something God does again and again and again, all the way to the book of the Revelation. When you get to the seven seals and the seven vials and those judgments of seven, those aren't end-to-end judgments. Those are judgments of seven, then they loop back and they go back over another seven, and then they loop back and they go over another seven. That's looping parallelism. The Bible does that all the time. Let me tell you another thing that just popped into my mind about that. If you take the first three chapters, you can't imagine how I've been studying on this, and I find myself going, I've got my Bible in my hand, and I've got Genesis here and Revelation here. The first three chapters of the Bible are all concluded in the last three chapters of the Bible. Everything that gets out of order here is all set back. It's almost like the last three chapters of the book of Revelation take you back to the original creation, and God can now get on with what he's wanted to do in the beginning. The first three chapters are looked upon, though, by scientists today and scholars today as myth and fable. so-called learned men will tell you that the Bible account is foolish, it's childish, it should be taken as superstitious, it's the thinking of unenlightened individuals, and they'll tell you it's been soundly proven to be mistaken and wrong by science. And they'll talk about a consensus of scientists will tell you that these first three chapters of Genesis are wrong. And sadly, it's viewed that way by a lot of folks who call themselves Christians. And I know with Andrew here today, it reminds me, when he was at Lewisburg, didn't you? You had to do a writing or something about it. They taught that very thing. Lewisburg was founded by what, Methodists? Was that Methodist? Yeah. But even their Bible teachers at this Methodist-founded college said, well, we can't really trust those first three chapters. Yeah. And didn't you at the end of it all, after you got your A, didn't you go up and tell him that you didn't believe a word of it, of what he said? Oh, they asked you to write, yeah, they asked you to write a recommendation for how the class could be made better or something. Yeah, and he told them how it could be made better. Science and academia, from the time that you are the youngest child in the youngest kindergarten you can get into until graduate school in university, embraces what they call the Big Bang Theory. And by the way, you know what a theory is? Theory is tradesman's talk for a guess. It's the Big Bang guess. That's what a theory is. They're guessing at it. And the theory or the guess of evolution, from the time you are a little child until you graduate university, the idea of the Big Bang, and Eric's here in class today, and it's being challenged, but it's not got out of the curriculum. It's still in the curriculum. Am I not right? Yeah. And of course, the theory of evolution. And by the way, Charles Darwin was not near the beginning of evolution. He learned what he learned from a guy by the name of Lyell, and there was a whole bunch of evolutionists that came to be and built everything until Darwin finally took the Beagle down to the Galapagos, and he wrote his Origin of Species. And when he did that, to show you how fervent all of this was in the United States at that time and in the world at that time, when Darwin came out with that, and I think Origin of Species was published in 1858, it sold out on the first day that it was published. That's how ripe the Enlightenment had gotten the world ready for receiving evolution. Anyway, all of that is in direct contrast to what we just read. And God himself, by the way, who was there when it happened? He did it. He was there when it happened. Darwin wasn't there. These guys, all of these scientists, they weren't there. I have the record of somebody who was actually there and who cannot lie and certainly is not guessing. No guessing. It's not a theory. We've noted how that God most likely created the angelic beings, including this one named Lucifer, on day one, and on day two, possibly, Lucifer has sinned at that time, fallen from his lofty position of the anointed cherub that covered the very throne room of God, which God will explain later on in Ezekiel 28. And as I say, God doesn't pronounce day two as good. Now, Satan takes, as we've talked about, usurped dominion of the heavenly realm first. Let's go back to that chart that we looked at on Wednesday night. When Satan falls, he knows that God has got two paralleled governmental structures. One governmental structure is in the heavenly places. The other governmental structure is on this earth. He takes the heavenly realm first. And we noted that and went over these verses on Wednesday night. And then in Genesis 3, we have the record of how he came to the earth in the guise of that serpent and usurped the dominion and took the possession of the earth second. And this, what we commonly call fall of Lucifer into becoming the Satan. Satan, by the way, is a title more than it is a name, and it means the adversary of God. This becoming God's adversary, this chart, what we went over, this is important because it sets up the contention between God and Satan, between God and that adversary of over this one issue. Who is going to be the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth? And we've looked at that. That expression comes right out of Genesis 14:19, when Melchizedek was talking to Abraham. He talks about, blessed be the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. That's the full title. In Isaiah 14, Isaiah records five of Satan's original I wills. And his last one was, I will be like the Most High. And he doesn't give the whole title, but it's the Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. That's the contention. That's the battle. That's the war. That contention or battle between God and Satan is over who will have the legal right and be the rightful possessor of heaven and earth. The battle is not one of strength versus strength. Satan isn't stupid. He knows he's a created being. If he took God on physically, he would be beat every time. It's not a battle over material strength. Satan isn't trying to get up more possessions than God does. It's not a battle over military strength. Rather, it is a battle of wits. It's a battle over wisdom. Whose wisdom? Who will be the wisest? And Satan boasted himself to be even wiser than Daniel at one point. And he almost threw his fist in God's face and said, there is no secret you can keep from me. Yeah. It's going to be a battle of superior wisdom. There's going to be wisdom that has to do with tactics. There's going to be wisdom that has to do with strategy. All of that wisdom that Satan thinks he can match wits with God and accomplish, excuse me, his plan without God's grace, and to be able to do it on his own rather than God and his greater wisdom. But that's what it's over. And really, that's what the whole history of the earth is all about in a nutshell. That's what it's all about. You're caught up in it. When Satan tempted Eve in the Garden of Eden, it wasn't just an attempt to try to corrupt her and Adam and get the high hand over her and Adam. There was something even more rudimentary, more fundamental, more basic than that. They were the means by which he was going to usurp the dominion of the earth. Adam was the monarch of the earth. By the way, if you want to talk about who was the wealthiest man of all time, Adam. He owned everything. God told him to have dominion over all of it. Every piece of gold, every diamond, every piece of silver, every square inch of property. What would you estimate Adam's worth would have been? And the Garden of Eden wasn't just a place that had tulips and roses in it. The Garden of Eden was a palace. God designed the Garden of Eden. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But God designed that to be the residence and the palace of a monarch. And there's so much significance about the garden and God planting that garden. We're going to talk about that a little bit, hopefully today as well, about God planting that garden and where on this earth he chose a piece of real estate and he put it there because that's the place he's going to live. And he wanted Adam there with him. And Adam began in that very residence where God was going to live on this earth. And that's one of the reasons why every pagan religion that came out of Babylon has got some kind of goofy garden associated with it. And they used those gardens for some of the most disgusting things that you can possibly imagine, both sexually disgusting and even to the point of sacrificing children. And that's one of the reasons why God would always tell the nation of Israel to tear down their idols and their groves, where their gardens were located and everything. And again, the reason people misunderstand what God is doing is because they haven't gone back far enough to get the idea of what's going on. Well, you can't go back any farther than we did today. So, the battle is on. And in a nutshell, all of human history, the history of the whole earth, is about this contention between God and the adversary of who will be the most high possessor of heaven and earth. Now, I want to deal with something here that I think will be of interest to some of you who haven't even been over all of this, or who have been over all of it. I want you to realize God does this for a reason. And let's go back to this. Let's just get this down here. And I think we can put this on. Genesis 1:1-3. All right. Here's creation. So we've zoomed in on our timeline chart, and we know all the way down yonder is going to be when God establishes his kingdom, but not even that's known right now in Genesis 1-3. His kingdom is supposed to be set up here in Genesis. It was to be, I can biblically be accurate and know the date when the kingdom was going to be set up. It was going to be set up. You remember what was the seventh day? A Sabbath, right? God rested from his work. The very next week, that second Sabbath, after that first one, God was going to bring a city that he had created in the heavenly realm, his city, his residence, his abode, and put it on the earth. But he didn't, because the adversary struck in that amount of time. And so this is all a giant parenthesis to get back to here. So anyway, let's look at something very interesting here. God created this for a reason. And I want to do something else here too. By his creation of heaven and earth, and the angelic world and all the creatures on the earth, and man as his ultimate and most special creature of all, God intends to set forth something. He intends to show something, to manifest something. He wants to show his entire essence and character and what it's all about. But the most particular reason for why God created all things is found in a passage such as Revelation chapter 4, verse 11. Now, I'll read that for you. But before we do that, let's do it this way. Revelation chapter 4, verse 11. If you want to turn there, that's fine. We looked at this when we looked at God's glory. And remember, at no time when Satan sins in the heavenly realm, when you read about it in Ezekiel 28, when he was lifted up in his pride and all his arrogance and everything, at any time, God could have just gone like, I dream a genie, blink, and just wiped it all out. Just, it's all gone, like that, in a moment. Like erase the board. And then maybe look at God the Son and say, well, let's start over. Who would have faulted him? Nobody. His righteousness was offended. Why didn't his justice take that action? Instead, God chose to let it play out. That's a fascinating thing. I'll tell you one of the reasons why he did it, because he knew that he could beat this guy. But there are aspects of who God is as a father, as a loving God, as mercy, long-suffering, gracious, as one who provides for his creation and loves his creation, that would never have been put on display like it is had he just left it the way it was and let it play out And that's exactly what he's done. Now, there's thousands of things we could get into in that realm. I want to try to keep this on track a little bit. But notice here at the end of the Bible in Revelation chapter 4, verse 11, it says, "Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power." There's that original contention of who is going to be God Most High, possessor, that's power. "For thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created." God created the world not only simply because he wanted to, but it says he did so for his pleasure. He designed this world, this earth, to derive pleasure from it. As we will see, he created it so that he could live here. He intends to live here, not Mars, not Jupiter. Here. And I'll tell you right now, and this is my opinion or what my position. Say what you want about all of astronomy, science. I do believe that they will find one day that the earth really is in the center of it all. We are the center. I know they're talking about, well, we're way out of whack with everything else. Like, they know everything else. But the earth is more special than any other. And boy, how people hate that. You can't say something's more special. You think you're more special than me? You can't say the earth is more special than Mars. The heck I can't. It is more special. And it's not threatened by global warming or climate change. I guarantee you we're going to have four seasons this year. Four distinct seasons. God created it for his pleasure. And if God's pleasure is the issue, and it being pleasing unto him, that connects directly to God's glory. And the very glory of God will be manifested in his creation, both in its original state and even in its fallen and cursed state. As sin entered the heavenly realm and it finally enters the earthly realm, with all that sin and everything, God is still going to have it work out to his honor and his glory. One other passage I want you to see, and come over with me to this one, Isaiah chapter 45. And then we're going to set this up for what we're going to do next session. Isaiah chapter 45. This is a great chapter because Paul quotes this in Romans chapter 9. But come down and pick it up for time's sake. We're really out of time for the first session. Come down to verse 15. By the way, this is oftentimes a verse that's appealed to show you a contradiction in the Bible. Look at what Isaiah says here in verse 18. He says, "For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens." Now, he uses heavens plural there, as he should, because now he's talking about, he understands there's three heavens. There's the heaven where the birds fly. There's the heaven where that's the first heaven. There's the heavens where the stars are all at. And then there's a third heaven above all of that, which is the throne room of God. And Paul will talk about being taken up to the third heaven. That's what he's talking about. Anyway, he says, "For thus saith the Lord that," and by the way, the capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, that's Jehovah God, "that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he hath established it, he created it not in vain, he formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord and there is none else." This is often appealed to and as a contradiction to what it says in Genesis 1:2. And they'll oftentimes say, "Well, how can you square this with what God says in Genesis? Because in Genesis, didn't he create it in vain?" That's not what it said. All right? Look at it. I'm going to make sure I got it right. The earth was without form and void. Genesis 45:18. God created it not in vain. Vain and void aren't the same thing. Anyway, he didn't create it in vain. He's going to inhabit it, and we learn that he's going to live here himself. God created the heavens and the earth to be inhabited by creatures. There's a lot of bears and lions and tigers and all kinds of creatures on this earth, but especially by a special creature named Adam, mankind, who would please God and honor him and glorify him. The whole animal kingdom will do that one day, by the way. Understand that the animal kingdom is going to get reset in God's kingdom to the way it originally was supposed to be, where you could order a lion around and it'll do it. You can tell, instead of you carrying your groceries in, get your baboon to do it. You don't want to mow your yard, get an elephant to do it. Scientists say, did you know that certain gorillas can be taught sign language? Well, animals used to actually speak. I have no trouble with that. There's birds that can talk and all that kind of thing. You'll notice when the serpent spoke to Eve, she didn't go, Adam, why is that animal talking? She expected it. Probably heard a lot of them speaking. The whole world, even the trees are going to clap. The fauna is going to rejoice in a way in which you don't even know. God looks at us and he says, you don't even know what that weed can do to glorify me. Where do you see what this creation can do when it's unleashed? And with the curses lifted off of it. Even though sin has entered the earthly realm and the earth, and even though Satan has usurped the dominion of the heavenly realm and the earth, even though for the most part all of the creatures on the earth are currently pleasing Satan and not pleasing God, it is God who created the heavens and the earth and all its creatures and designed for that creation to be a pleasure unto himself and for it to be inhabited by ones who would honor and glorify him. Now, beginning in our next lesson, we're going to take a break here, but we're going to start looking at this another issue of why God created the heavens and the earth. And I'm going to show you something here just to bait you a little bit, and the reason why I reread those verses. On day one and day two, the earth didn't look like that. The earth was encased. Isn't that cool? Watch. Yeah. The earth was encased in water. Water covered the entire earth. Why did he do that? Why did God create the earth encased in water? Why didn't he just create it with the land showing? But he didn't. He created it completely covered in water. Huh? Yeah, that's a really good observation, like a baby. But God, we're going to see there are three major significant things the Bible sets forth about water. And those three reasons are going to be important as to why God started this the way he did. He's drawing your attention to something with that water. And we're going to find out what it is next session. So we'll stop right there and we'll come back and answer the question, why did God create the earth encased in water? It looks like you're chilly. Are you cold?